I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in this week for Kathleen Dunn. Happy to be with you. And we are going to talk about a topic today that I think affects a lot of people and that all of us should be concerned about. There was an article on WBUR in Boston's Common Health website, and the article was titled A Phrase to Renounce for 2014, The Mentally Ill. And in it, there were many quotes from Dr. Paul Sommergrad. He's president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association and also psychiatrist-in-chief at the Tufts Medical Center. We're going to talk with him for about the first two-thirds of the program, and then we're going to take a look a little closer to home. We're going to talk then with William Park Sutherland, who's executive director of Grassroots Empowerment Project. That's a Wisconsin statewide nonprofit that is controlled and directed by mental health consumers and survivors. And throughout the program, we are going to play some audio clips of people who very generously shared their experiences living with a diagnosed mental illness and what it means to them, the stigma that's attached, the phrase, the mentally ill, and what they think we can do to improve their experience. So I think it's going to be a very rich and interesting hour, and we hope that you'll join in, whether you yourself are living with a diagnosed mental illness or someone that you love or work with or care about is, whether the phrase the mentally ill has ever struck you as being an issue, and if you have an idea for a better way to refer to people who are living with a diagnosis. You can join in at our Madison number. We're broadcasting out of Madison this week. It's 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Paul Sommergrad, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, this article really caught our eye, and I think it's a really important issue to talk about. The term the mentally ill, how long has that been in common usage, would you say?
You know, I'm not really sure. I mean, it certainly is something that has come up to my attention in the last couple of years. It tends to be in media or sometimes in headlines, in newspapers, or kind of common parlance on television. And when Carrie Goldberg, who wrote the piece for the Common Health blog for WBUR, and I talked about it, it was something that had struck her as well. So I'd say that certainly from my own perspective, I've thought about it more in the last couple of years, but I don't know how far back it really goes.
Well, and you are a practicing psychiatrist, but you are also president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association, which is, I'm guessing, quite a bully pulpit in your field. Why is this shift in language a priority for you in that position?
Well, there are lots of different reasons, but let me say a little bit about what troubled me about the terminology. And it came about, actually, I think I first noticed it most recently when there was the mental health parity final rule came out. This is a rule that allows, make sure that people who have mental health concerns or disorders don't get discriminated against in the way insurance companies provide care for them. So, for example, you know, if you don't have a limitation on visits for your diabetes care, you shouldn't have limitation of visits for your depression care, or if you have to jump through certain kinds of hoops to get inpatient psychiatric care, those shouldn't be different than the hoops you jump through to get inpatient medical care. So, this had come out a number of months ago, and the administration had actually done a very good job on it. And the New York Times had an editorial that was a terrific editorial. The actual content of the editorial was great. But the headline was parody for the mentally ill. And it just struck me that it was language that was problematic in several ways. First of all, the definite article, the, made it sound as if people who have mental health concerns or mental illness are somehow this different, unique category that one could describe as being someplace over there and away from our brothers and sisters and parents and selves and families. And indeed, mental health concerns are very common. The epidemiology of mental disorders of various kinds is about 25% of the U.S. population at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just felt like language that was, number one, distancing. The second problem with the language is that when you say the mentally ill, it's as if everybody is in some kind of singular category. We
right.
don't talk about the physically ill. If we say someone is ill, we may say, well, gee, somebody's sick, and then we'll say something about the kind of problem that they're having. So, you know, the example I've used in the past is that when Steve Jobs was sick, people didn't say, gee, you know, Steve Jobs is physically ill. Mm-hmm. They said he's sick, and then they said, you know, he has a form of pancreatic cancer, but no, he actually has a rare neuroendocrine form of pancreatic cancer, which is much more specific, descriptive, and frankly near to that experience of that individual. And I think that the language we use around mental health considerations ought to be similarly more sensitive and less as if we're putting everybody into some kind of box someplace. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Carrie Goldberg, as you said, the author of the article on the WBUR website, said, and I think it kind of made me chuckle because I think we're taught from an early age that this is one way to kind of, as a test of whether what we're saying is okay or not, she kind of, she tried using that definite article, the, with other groups, and she said as a thought experiment, she tried the headline, quote, equal coverage for the women, and she said, that's weird, and then she said, new era for the gays, that's offensive, and crime and the blacks, and then she says, I get the point.
Right.
And, you know, it's kind of interesting how easy it is to see the problems in it when you substitute other groups of human beings.
Right. I mean, and there's nothing wrong, I guess, in some sense with the term mental illness per se or mental disorders or psychiatric illness. I mean, there needs to be shorthand ways of describing all sorts of things. The other problem with this is that in general, that when we use the term the mentally ill or someone says someone has mental illness, it often carries a connotation, and the connotation may be different for different people. But again, I think language that's more close to people's experience, their real lived experience, the specifics of the kinds of problems they have. Because after all, when people have mental health, you know, or substance use, you know, disorders, it covers everything from attention deficit disorder and autism in kids to anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive disorders, dementing illnesses, delirium in older individuals, as well as mood disorders of various kinds, bipolar illness, schizophrenia, other forms of psychotic illness. It's a wide range of conditions. It's not some unimodal thing that is then easy to say, oh, that's those people over there. You know, it's kind of like the terminology when people, you know, would use racially charged language like you people. You know, it's language that says that this is some group that somehow is different than me, different than the people. And the reality is, you know, I don't know what it's like, you know, for people, you know, your listeners, and I hope we hear from them. But, you know, there are tons of people who I run across every day, and not just in a professional capacity, who have some or another form of mental health condition. It's not unusual. As a matter of fact, it's relatively common. And so to use this language as if it's something very distant, I think is really problematic and unfair to people.
We are talking with Dr. Paul Sommergrad. He is the president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. We are talking about the phrase, the mentally ill, and how we can perhaps work toward breaking down the stigma of mental illness and whether there are different phrases that perhaps we can use that are more respectful and more supportive for people who are living with a mental illness diagnosis. We, as Dr. Sommergrad said, we would certainly welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Are you living with a diagnosed mental illness? What are your feelings about the term the mentally ill? And is there a phrase you think would be more helpful? And we would especially like to know if you've experienced stigma in your life as a result of your mental illness. What are the most helpful and appreciated responses to your diagnosis that you've gotten from coworkers, from friends, or from family members? We'd love to have you join the conversation. And Dr. Sommergrad, let's take a listen to one of those audio clips that I said that we were able to collect. A big thanks to KP Whaley, our producer, for taking the time to interview these folks and record them. And a special thanks to the people who were willing to talk about their own experiences with mental illness. The first clip we're going to hear is from from a woman named Mary. She was diagnosed with very severe postpartum depression after the birth of her second child.
Every time I hear about a young mother committing suicide after birth, or even when I hear about the school shooters, they're people who very obviously need support and assistance and not stigmatization. And I think the more that people realize that, yes, these people are really and truly suffering from some illness, the better I think our treatment of them in the long run will be.
So Mary there talking about acting with compassion towards people who are suffering from mental illness and you know, not treating them as others. Dr. Sommergred, is there anything in what Mary said that really resonated for you?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, first of all, young mothers or, older mothers, who have postpartum illnesses of various kinds are, unfortunately are common occurrences as well. And again, on a spectrum from, what people sometimes used to call the baby blues to postpartum depression to more severe or acute kinds of cases of even postpartum psychosis, where people can develop, severe obsessions and preoccupations and even very difficult feelings towards their babies. In a very acute and overwhelming kind of way. And the sense that, again, I mean, one of the things that it triggered in me in hearing this was, what do we mean by calling something a mental disorder or a mental illness? As I think about it as a physician, what it means is that somebody has a disorder that affects thinking, mood, feeling, cognition in some way, or behavior. The causes of those disorders are not necessarily mental in the sense of being in one's mind or being caused by, there may be psychosocial stressors. There may be a combination of genetic and psychosocial stressors. There can be medical conditions that cause the onset of psychiatric symptoms. For example, steroids. People get, corticosteroids, glucocorticoids, prednisone, those kinds of medications for treatment of a variety of conditions often can produce either mania or depression. And certainly a known risk factor of a medical type for the development and the onset of a mental disorder, in this case is pregnancy and childbirth and being in the immediate postpartum period. So it should force us to think about our language very, very carefully. And the stigma issue, I think, is tremendously important. One of my favorite, I think my favorite quote about stigma actually comes from Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln, as people may know, suffered from severe depressions. And in 1841, he wrote a letter to his law partner, Joshua Speed's sister, Sarah. And the term in the 19th century for depression was melancholy. And Lincoln wrote, and I'm quoting, "A tendency to melancholy is a misfortune, not a fault." And I just thought, God, that's so beautiful and so simple and so right to the heart of this, because we tend to view mental disorders as something that should be within someone's control, and obviously to the extent that people can control anything in their lives, they should. But these really are misfortunes and sufferings, not necessarily something that people should be blamed for. And yet our language tends to get confused about this, and I think Mary's comment reflects that.
We are talking with Dr. Paul Sommergred. He is the president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. We're talking about a recent article that appeared on the WBUR Boston's health website, and it's called A Phrase to Renounce for 2014, The Mentally Ill. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. We'd love to have you join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about a recent article on the WBUR Boston webpage, A Phrase to Renounce for 2014, that phrase being the mentally ill. And we are talking right now with Dr. Paul Sommergred. He's president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. And in just a little bit, we'll be talking with a Wisconsin advocate who works with people who are living with mental illness and works with an organization that both supports them and is directed by them. We ended the previous discussion discussion talking about stigma. And as I mentioned, we have several clips of people living with mental illness who were willing to share their experiences. And so I'd like to get a couple of those in right now as well. And let's listen to this next one.
In my case, I lost my family. I lost all my friends. When my mental health diagnosis kind of came to a head, when it was at its worst, I lost everything. And so for me to get into a relationship with somebody, whether it's a doctor or just a new friend or whatever, and share my story is difficult because the last time it came out, I lost so much, and that hurts. So it's hard to put yourself in that position again.
That was Matt, and let's now listen to Russell.
I have noticed that I have had friends not maintain contact with me, I think, after I disclosed my mental illness. I wondered about why they would not wish to maintain contact with me merely on the basis of some diagnosis of mental illness, because I'm otherwise the same person. I share my diagnosis freely in a professional capacity because my work involves that, but on a personal level, I'm more reluctant to share it.
Again, those were clips of people living with mental illness who were willing to share their experiences with us, and we really appreciate that. Dr. Sommergrad, did you have something to add to what Matt and Russell had to say?
No, I think it's all too often a common experience for people who are living with mental illness or mental disorders of some type, that there's a tendency to view, and again, you know, some of our recent terrible tragedies have certainly reinforced, you know, a misperception, for example, that individuals with, you know, who have various forms of mental illness are more violent than other individuals or more dangerous to be around. And the reality is that there's no greater rate of violence among individuals, even with severe mental illness, who are treated. For example, there's a slight increase among people with severe mental illness and combination of mental illness and substance abuse, but it's a very, very small contributor to the total amount of violence and crime that we see around us. So there's a lot of fear and a lot of history around these disorders. These disorders are not new disorders. They're disorders that have been recorded. They're in the Bible. They're in the early Greek physicians' writings. And some of them have been very, very frightening and fearsome disorders because they're so close to us in some way. I mean, these are illnesses that are the most intimate of all human illnesses because they affect our sense of self in the deepest recesses of our sense of self. And oftentimes, individuals themselves struggle with the sense of how much of this is me, how much of this is my fault, how much of this really defines who I am. And so individuals really have to struggle with that and come to terms with it. You know, my favorite story about that, there's a woman named Ellen Sachs, who is a law professor. Actually, she has an endowed chair at the University of Southern California, went to Yale, and then to Oxford, and then to Yale Law School, and then developed a schizophrenia during the time that she was in college and in law school, had multiple hospitalizations, lots and lots of intensive psychiatric care, both medication and psychotherapy. And she said, and I heard her say this at a meeting recently, she said it took her about 10 years of care before she finally could accept the fact that she had a mental illness. And after that, when she truly accepted it, she realized that it didn't define who she was. And so I think that that interplay between a sense of self and a sense of illness is particularly strong around these conditions, and also the issues of behavior, because it, you know, by their definition, mental disorders of various kinds, you know, affect behavior. Take the person, for example, with obsessive compulsive disorder who washes their hands multiple hours a day. That affects their overt behavior. So obviously, you know, there are things about all of this that I think we need to become more familiar with, not just because individuals are suffering with these conditions, but because they're so common and they affect so many people and they have such an impact on medical care costs, on the justice system, people being in jail because of their mental illness, and a whole variety of school systems, a whole variety of other areas. We need a more open conversation, and I think that was part of the impetus for Carrie's article.
Let's go to the phones now, and Marcus in Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. Thank you for this program.
Sure.
And thank you for all the people in the medical field who have chosen that, you know, to help people like us. But as far as stigma, I think one of the problems with people understanding mental illness is, first of all, it's very hard to treat. I remember when I first started this out in 87, I checked myself in the hospital for drug and alcohol, and they called it the shotgun effect or something, where they just kept throwing medications at people and hoping that one would work. And it's still kind of like that. It's just so hard to narrow it down. It's not as simple as high blood pressure, even though that's complicated too. But I mean, so that's one thing that we then go on treated, or even medications that really messed me up back in the 80s, giving me really strong meds. And I think it's hard for people to cope with it also, because sometimes it forces people to take a look at themselves and they don't want to. And it's in nature, it's, you know, predators prey on the weak. And if they see any sign of weakness, they can pounce and use that against you. And I hear myself now, I'm almost sounding angry, but, you know, I think there needs to be more compassion and understanding and more learning about this. And everybody has good points to the max. You know, there's no such thing as a bad person. And I just want to say that it should be talked about in conversations. I've had the support of my three daughters and my ex-wife still, since I checked myself in, and I'm still on a rocky boat sometimes. But, the support and people, you know, not using it against you, and you can talk once in a while and trust them. And I don't know. I just think maybe folks should sometimes take a look at their own selves and stop talking about everybody else sometimes, darn it. So thanks for hearing me out.
Thank you, Marcus. We really appreciate your call. Dr. Sommergren?
Well, certainly, we do have better evidence about both the nature of these illnesses and both their causes and treatments for them, but we don't have as good an evidence as we need, nor do we have the range of either medications or psychotherapies or other kinds of treatments, as fully as we need. And we certainly need more research, as I think is implicit in what Mark has said. The other thing is, one of the ways in which this won't change unless people actually talk about their own selves and their conditions, and that's a hard thing to do. So for Marcus to come on and talk about this requires, real bravery,
Yes. And
that's not an easy thing for people to do.
And let's go back to the phones and Chris in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hey, the cold broke.
I haven't been out yet today, so I'll take your word for it.
The sun is actually out. Holy cow. I have a horror story. I filed a sexual harassment complaint against a bunch of sexual predators teaching in the UWM art department. This was in 1986. The university took a position from very early on in this that I was making everything up and that I was nuts. When it was finally settled out, there was a lot of money, a lot of taxpayer money got paid out to everybody. Catherine Lyle, the president of System, told me specifically aimed at me that I would not be dealt with because I had serious mental problems. Now, the fact of the matter is that I'm suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorder, and depression as a direct result of what they did to me. But that line of discourse has never changed within the context of the university. Mm. And in 2000, I lost my home because of it, my home of 20 years, and all of my stuff was stolen, and my life was threatened. When I migrated to Madison because Milwaukee mm-hmm. was just not working, and I started pushing some buttons in Madison, and they sicked the Madison SWAT team on me.
Okay, Chris, just because we have a lot, no, and I appreciate what you're saying. We have a lot of people I want to get to, so I want to give Dr. Sommergrad a chance to respond. I think part of what Chris is talking about is that when someone who's living with a mental illness is dealing with other systems or other issues, sometimes for that professional or that whoever you're dealing with, the mental health issue comes to the forefront when that's really not what the person is asking for help with.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly can happen. The other thing is, you know, again, within, you know, the kind of can't speak about Chris's case, but, you know, within the context of the legal system, you know, there's a long history of there being, you know, conditions or situations where mental health issues or mental illness concerns come up, you know, appropriately within the legal or other settings, and there are other situations where it may be used in ways that are less appropriate. And again, you know, without speaking to her particular case, you know, one has to take these on a kind of case by case and individual basis and look at them very carefully.
Let's go back to the phones and Lynn in Verona. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I wanted to say again, thank you so much for this topic. My own diagnosis is depression and generalized anxiety disorder. And I guess the reason why I resent the term mental illness is because it kind of implies that all you need to do is take a pill and you can get better. That it's just like having a sinus infection or something. It's just real easy to fix up. And for me, just like with Marcus, that has not been the case. I've been through probably at least a dozen different medications without real success. I still take my meds every day. They help. They take the edge off. But I've had to come to accept that this is just the way I was made. And my job is to do the best I can in spite of this way that I was made. It's not my fault. It's just the hand of cards that I was dealt for my life. So as long as I can do the best I can and try to accomplish what I can with my life, I'm okay. You know, and that's what gets me through day by day.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Lynn. And Dr. Sommergrad?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you know her saying that. And again, you know, and again, even Lynn's comments I think are very important. Again, because you know there are within this large spectrum and range of mental health disorders that we think about, you know, even within ranges of illnesses that we may think about as being less severe, like anxiety, for example, or depression, people can have situations where their responsiveness is less robust to either medication or to psychotherapy. And that even when people do respond, and many people respond very well, and we tend to not necessarily always hear about the success stories because people try to keep, you know, these stories private because of the stigma and other related issues. The reality is all of us as human beings have to live with the cards that we're dealt and mm-hmm. to do the best we can. And that certainly when people have more significant mental health concerns, the ability to still live one's life, achieve what one wants to achieve, and aim for both the greatest amount of both recovery and dignity is very, very important.
And I think, too, Dr. Sommergrad, that Lynn brought up an interesting point that we referred to earlier. She didn't bring it up directly in what she said, but it's a good example of it. We talked earlier about how one of the problems with the phrase the mentally ill is that it treats everyone who is living with a mental health diagnosis as a unified group, as all having the same challenges and ideas about their mental illness. And actually, she was saying that, you know, to her, it's so much more complex than having a medical issue that the whole illness idea makes it sound easier to treat than it really is. On the other hand, we have an audio clip here from Russell, who we heard from earlier as well. And he has a different take than Lynn on the comparison to a physical health diagnosis. So let's listen to that.
If someone, like in my case, as bipolar disorder, it has value to use language like he has bipolar disorder rather than he is bipolar. To say he is bipolar suggests that it's
an all-encompassing primary core definition of who that person is, that this person needs to be known by that. If we say he has bipolar illness or he has bipolar disorder, it's one part of his larger identity, sometimes referred to as facets of a diamond. It's just one facet of a whole person.
That was from Russell, who is one of the many people who generously shared their time and their thoughts with us on this topic of the phrase, the mentally ill. And Dr. Sommergred, is what Russell said something that you hear often?
I think that's exactly what we were trying to say. I think he said it beautifully. You know, to say that one is, you know, bipolar indicates that that's kind of a core element of their identity and who they are. It defines them by their illness, as opposed to saying they are a person who happens to have, you know, flat feet and bipolar disorder and, you know, maybe thinning hair or whatever the combination of things are that all of us have as we get older or as we live our lives. So I think that's very, very important to not define people as if they are their diagnoses. The diagnoses are useful tools and rubrics to help figure out how to best potentially care for people. They're not perfect. They need to be improved. But they're certainly not definitional of who people are. I think the other problem with the term the mentally ill is the connotation, and I think Carrie Goldberg pointed this out in one of the things that she wrote in the article, is that it usually implies that people are, you know, psychotic, out of control in some way, and obviously there are individuals who have very severe mental illnesses or very severe experiences of mental illness that can include psychosis, and those are very critical to care for and to take care of and to provide support. But to say that everybody fits into one bucket is really a problem, and I think Russell's comments really speak to that.
We are going to continue this conversation about the phrase the mentally ill and people who are living with mental health issues with another guest in just a few minutes. But before we let you go, Dr. Paul Sommergred, I wanted to listen to this short clip from the State of the Union address last night from President Barack Obama. It does seem like there is a growing awareness of veterans and mental health issues and that there is something of a commitment on the federal level. Let's take a quick listen to that clip from the State of the Union address.
My fellow Americans, no other country in the world does what we do. On every issue, the world turns to us, not simply because of the size of our economy or our military might, but because the ideals we stand for and the burdens we bear to advance them. No one knows this better than those who serve in uniform. As this time of war draws to a close, a new generation of heroes returns to civilian life. We'll keep slashing that backlog so our veterans receive the benefits they've earned and our wounded warriors receive the health care, including the mental health care that they need.
That was from the State of the Union address last night. President Barack Obama calling for support for returning veterans, mental health parity, as we talked about earlier. Dr. Paul Sommergred, just concluding with you here, might that be an avenue for there being more acceptance and less stigma for people living with mental health issues in general?
I certainly hope so. And obviously, the most important thing is to provide care for our returning heroes for both the visible but also the invisible wounds of war. You know, post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury are the signature wounds of these conflicts. And the need to provide that care for our veterans, many of whom are getting care, frankly, not just in Veterans Administration hospitals, but in general hospitals and in communities, offices of physicians and other providers. So it's critical that we provide care for them, both within the VA system, but also within the general system. It's part of why parity is so important. And I think, you know, it is certainly a group that we have a very profound responsibility to. And I hope that people's understanding of this and their compassion towards individuals who suffer these conditions will extend not just to veterans, but to all of the individuals who are suffering. But certainly the experience of veterans is very, very important to all of us.
Dr. Paul Sommergrad, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Paul Sommergrad is president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association. He is also psychiatrist-in-chief at Tufts Medical Center. And he was interviewed as part of an article on WBUR's website called A Phrase to Renounce for 2014, The Mentally Ill. Well, we are going to stay on this topic, and I hope that our callers who are online will stay with us. We are going to turn the focus a little closer to home. We're coming up next. We're going to talk with William Park Sutherland. He's executive director of Grassroots Empowerment Project, which is a Wisconsin statewide nonprofit that is controlled and directed by mental health consumers and survivors. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are now going to talk with William Park Sutherland, who is executive director of Grassroots Empowerment Project. It's a Wisconsin statewide nonprofit that is controlled and directed by mental health consumers and survivors. And William, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Judith.
Well, I think we got a good start on the conversation with Dr. Paul Sommergrad. And as president-elect of the American Psychiatric Association, he certainly has something of a bully pulpit to help advance this issue. But, you know, bringing it back to Wisconsin, would you describe the situation in Wisconsin as significantly different for people living with a diagnosed mental illness than perhaps in other places?
I think Marcus and Lynn and the other callers did a very good job of explaining from their personal experience what it's like to live with mental health challenges or live with a diagnosed mental illness. I also want to commend Dr. Sommergrad for the topic and talking about the importance of eliminating the words that label us. I'm also a person with lived experience of mental illness. And more importantly than trying to figure out a good label or the best label, mm-hmm. What really will reduce the stigma and the discrimination that people with mental illness face is getting to know us as people beyond our labels. And that's why Marcus and Lynn's comments really resonated with me, talking about how they are not just their label. They are people, they have lives, they do things. I mean, mental illness affects many, many people, and people are living very positive, fulfilling, meaningful lives. And if policymakers and medical providers and other people get to know us beyond our labels and get to understand the complications of us as individual people, I think that will go a long way into eliminating the stigma that we face.
In that WBUR Boston article, A Phrase to Renounce for 2014, The Mentally Ill, author Carrie Goldberg sat down with some new peer specialists who are people who are living with mental illness and who are helping to provide support to people as well. And they were re-educating her about the use of language. And they were really emphasizing what you also just said, William, about the rightness of using people-first language. And she writes, yes, people-first language is less concise, but a couple of added words seems a small price to pay for according greater dignity to people facing extra challenges. And I think that really ties in with what you were saying, that it's human beings, it's people who happen to be living with this diagnosis.
I think that's a good first step. I think the next step is that I'm not only a person living with post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety, but I'm a pool player, I'm an executive director, I have thinning hair, and I drive a Honda Fit. I mean, there's more to everyone than our diagnosis, and no matter how carefully you say the diagnosis, if that's all you say, you're really missing the boat, which is that these attitudes change when you when people get to know us as individuals.
Mm-hmm. We have some folks who have been waiting to join the conversation, so let's go to the phone and Sue in Appleton. Hi, Sue.
Hi there. Thanks so much for the opportunity to talk.
Sure.
I have 2 points, and one is pretty much agreeing with the put the person first idea. I've been a special ed teacher, and we were trained, thankfully, to say a student with autism, a child with autism, Gary with autism, what have you. And I feel very strongly that that is very, very important. A lot of folks do not understand what value there is in that, but I believe that families who have a family member, and I'll say with autism, and this is true for other brain problems, they know all about their family member, and they don't, definitely don't, only think of them as mm-hmm. as the disability first. And so I agree that we should not say that's a bipolar person. Mm-hmm. That is very, very uncomfortable for me. But the second point is, you've been talking about what else can we call the mentally ill. And I'm wondering, why not use brain disorder?
Hmm. So the term brain disorder, William, what would you say to that?
I would say that there's a lot of people who would agree that that might be a good term. And then there's a lot of people who would disagree. One of the complications of this, and I think it's something that Marcus and Lynn touched on, which is the science behind the creation, symptomology, treatment of mental illness or brain disorders or psychiatric disorders is still relatively controversial. It isn't as controversial to talk about the treatment of diabetes. We have treatments. I haven't heard people talk about how they were on 12 different medications and none of them worked. And, you know, the psychiatrist is just kind of throwing something and saying, well, let's see if this works. And I think that that's another part of this issue, is that because the science is controversial, people don't know. People have really a strong opinion about what they call themselves. Some people talk about consumers. In GDP, mm-hmm. You said consumer survivors. So consumers are consumers of services. Survivors are people who identify as people who've survived mental health treatment, not survived mm-hmm. mental illness.
Interesting. Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
Sure.
And let's go next to back to the phones, and Irene in Cedarburg. Hi, Irene.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thank you for this program. It's been great.
Oh, I'm glad.
Well, I would like to ask a question about depression and work. I personally have experienced huge trauma in my mid-20s, and since then I've had depression and anxiety to the point where, you know, I would stand in front of my fridge and just cry for an hour because, you know, I couldn't decide whether to eat the blueberry pastry mm-hmm. or a cranberry or a cherry pastry or something like that. Mm-hmm. So 8 years later, and, you know, I've kind of learned and coped with this whole thing without medications, and I've gone through talk therapy, and it's really doing great, great things for me. However, I've noticed that at work, you know, the common folk just do not understand what depression is, and depressed people are most often confused for being whiny, lazy, or, you know, it seems to imply to people who are uneducated on the subject that if one is affected by any mental illness, that this person is entirely unaccountable and unable to function under pressure at a high pace or in any team environment and unable to process life or even, you know, worse, has no point of reference to reality. And at the same time, you know, someone with any other physical illness, let's say somebody who has diabetes, you know, would be perfectly fine to take an extra break if they needed to, you know, grab a candy bar or they needed to, you know, their medication mm-hmm. or something, while, you know, if I had an anxiety attack at work, or if I woke up that morning just feeling completely like, you know, I have an elephant sitting on me, it would be, you know, I would be taken as someone who is just completely, you know, lazy, and so forth.
Right.
And, you know, people, I've noticed that people around me who don't show signs of mental illness, you know, they seem to love to have an opinion about those who do, in the sense where, you know, they think something is wrong with our values. And
right.
I'm just curious, what advice would you have for people who suffer from mental illness of any kind in their workplace? Should we come out and educate everybody around us, or basically risk and jeopardize our careers because,
right.
you know, I have been in the past kind of sanctioned for having anxiety and for not processing things in a quote-unquote normal way.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, Irene, let me stop you there so we have time to both have to have William Park Sutherland respond to that. But, William, before you do, a lot of what Irene was just saying really resonates with something, one of these audio clips that we have. Again, Mary, who we heard from earlier, who suffered from very severe postpartum depression after the birth of her daughter, she talks a lot about those same issues. So let's take a listen to that.
You know, being in the psychiatric unit, it gave me a new empathy and a new appreciation for people who are chronically suffering from mental health issues. I don't even like to often use the word mental. You know, for many years, people referred to children with developmental delays as people who were mentally retarded or mentally deficient. And I think there's a difference between what we call it now and the actual illness of the brain, because these are things that are either chemically or neurologically different about how the brain works. It's not a moral failing. It's not a choice. And it bothers me. It bothered me when I was in the hospital, and it bothered me for the people who remained there or who suffer from a chronic condition. That mental illness is the layman's and professional's term of choice.
Talking about the use of the phrase the mentally ill, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week, and we are talking right now with William Park Sutherland of the Grassroots Empowerment Project. So both the call from Irene and that clip of Mary speaking, does that resonate with you, William?
Yeah, I mean, I think it absolutely resonates. It's a perfect example of how when we are talking about what to call us, one of the best things we can do is if you can't just call somebody Irene, which we do have a need for some labels, is asking somebody what they want. I know people who would vehemently disagree with some of the things that Mary said because it doesn't reflect their personal experience. Their personal experience is more about their history of trauma and how that has shaped their environment, or people who talk about their environment growing up. So I think that there's a really there's not a simple answer, because one, we don't really know, and two, it's so close to people that you really just have to ask. The other thing, though, that when I was listening to Irene, that I thought is, wouldn't it be great if we challenged ourselves to have a wider acceptance of what normal means? One of the things that the Carrie in the article says is that we have disorders in thoughts, emotions, and behavior. Wouldn't it be great if we challenge ourselves to have a wider acceptance of normal regarding thoughts, emotions, and behavior, rather than walling them off and terming them things like illness or disorder? I think we'd go a long way if we did that. And one of the ways that we will do that is by getting to know people as individuals.
And I want to make sure people know where they can get information about the Grassroots Empowerment Project. William, why don't you tell us how we can find that?
Sure. So if you go to our website, which is www.grassrootspower.org, that's all one word, you can learn more about the organization, see our staff, and then see some of the projects that we're doing. Really quickly, one of the things I wanted to say is we're doing a project that brings policymakers and consumers together at the local level so that we can get this contact and people can tell their stories and interact as equals and start to see people as individuals. And I think we're going to start to build that.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining us, William.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was William Park Sutherland, Executive Director of Grassroots Empowerment Project, a Wisconsin statewide nonprofit. And earlier we talked with Dr. Paul Sommergrad. Thanks so much to Dave Potras for on-air production and KP Whaley for production. Stay tuned. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.